Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. In 14 states, stretching from Oregon to South Carolina, the crowds will soon start to pour in for Monday's Great American Eclipse. It's the first time in a century that the U.S. mainland will be in the path of the shadow that occurs when the moon hides the sun. So this eclipse will unfold before unprecedented numbers of eyes. Here in New Hampshire, we won't get the full show, or what's called the zone of totality. However, the sun will be about 60% hidden in our skies, so you'll still notice it. Just please only observe wearing eye protection. Today in The Exchange, our Granite State astronomy crew gets ready for the solar eclipse, and let's get you into our conversation. Your questions about this eclipse or your memories of past events are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. Mal, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And John, welcome back.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here, too.
And also with us, Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. And Nicole, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Well, Nicole, where are you going to be on Monday?
So I will be in Southern Illinois in the St. Louis area. I have a couch to crash on and a car rented. So hopefully we can actually chase away the clouds and get some good viewing.
So you're going to Southern Illinois. Mm-hmm. John, you're going to see the path of totality as well.
Yes, I'm going to Sweetwater, Tennessee. It's east of Nashville, which is also in the eclipse path. But I have family there, and it's near the place in the country. It's near the center line of the eclipse path. So the eclipse is nearly its maximum at that location. That's one of the reasons that we chose it.
And where are you going, Mal?
I'll be in Columbia, South Carolina.
I'm so jealous. I can't. Yeah. I'm going to be here. Not in the path of totality. Mal, what is the path of totality that the three of you will be in?
The path of totality basically is where the full shadow of the moon traverses across the country, starting in this case, as you said, from Oregon down to South Carolina as the last stop, and then out to sea for a little bit before it dissipates. But it's actually more known as the umbra, the darkest part of it. And that circle of the, if you could see it from space, you'd see this circle just plummeting across the United States. It takes about an hour and a half for it to cover 3,000 miles.
So that means it's going really fast.
It's moving about 2,000 miles an hour across the country. And it's about 170-ish miles in diameter. So if you're anywhere within that area where that circle is going to be crossing, then you'll get to see the total part of the total eclipse.
Well, and there's all sorts of cool maps and simulations, and we've put all sorts of stuff up on our website. So I really encourage folks to go there today, nhpr.org, because we put up some photos, maps, links, and so forth. So, Nicole, if I were, like you guys, in the zone of totality, would it get completely dark? What would happen to the sky?
So this will be my first total solar eclipse. So I have not experienced this myself, but yeah, it gets pretty dark and cold as well. The temperature drops for that little bit of a time that it's in darkness. So there'll be some interesting things to observe, you know, crickets, animal behavior, just the feeling of the whole sky going dark at that time. Like I said, I haven't experienced it myself, but I've been told it's quite an experience.
I heard that the temperature, John, could drop as much as 10 degrees very quickly. And interesting to see how animals react to this, you know, sudden change. Will it get super dark, John, or just kind of dark blue but not black?
Twilight.
Twilight.
Twilight,
okay.
Or dawn. It'll be dark enough to see stars, some of the brighter stars.
Oh, wow. That's
you
pretty
can
dark.
See Venus. You can see some of the planets that are in the sky, but it won't be dark as it as dark as it gets, because there's still enough light from the corona, the atmosphere of the sun shining from behind the moon, that still makes the sky relatively bright. So it's like twilight throughout the whole sky, which is kind of a neat effect, like Nicole said. It's really the behavior around you during totality is as interesting, almost as interesting as what's going on at the sun. It's really quite comical sometimes to see what people do and how they act during totality. They'll yell, they'll scream, they'll cry, they'll jump up and down. It's really exciting because it's like, how can this be happening and me being here seeing it? That's the kind of excitement you experience.
Well, how common, Mal, are total solar eclipses?
You get a total eclipse, I'd say, about every year and a half.
Oh, okay.
But there's usually two eclipses that happen during the course of any year. And that also goes along with lunar eclipses, too, because the lunar eclipse would be something that happens at a full moon. And then when the moon moves around to the other side of its orbit, you have the new moon, and that's the time it can block the sun. But it has to happen. Part of the equation is that the moon's orbit is tilted compared to the equator of the Earth, and so by about 5 degrees. And it's only when the moon is in that crossing point where it's crossing the equator of the Earth and lining up with the moon that with the sun, that you could have the possibility of some sort of solar eclipse.
But they're could pretty common, it sounds like.
Yeah. Usually twice a year is when those mechanics are set up so that will work.
So, Nicole, why is this one just making everybody go gaga?
Well, it's all about location. Although there's, you know, often some kind of total eclipse happening somewhere on Earth, chances are it's going to be over an ocean or over some part of land that's not as accessible to us here in North America. What's exciting is it's happening right across North America in the contiguous United States. So many of us who have not gotten a chance to see one because we can't go off traveling to exotic locations, it's going to be very accessible for us.
So lots of people in an easy, accessible way. I can't remember the number, but many, many millions of people are within a day's drive of this.
Yeah. Pretty much within a lot of people within a short day's drive, pretty much the entire U.S. within a longer day's drive from the eclipse path.
John, what else stands out about this eclipse for you? Again, there have been all sorts of superlatives about it.
Well, being that it only touches American soil, it's being touted as, by some institutions, the Great American Eclipse, because it only touches American soil, which is kind of rare. Usually, the eclipse path crosses into multiple countries. But this one is just an American event. And as Mal pointed out, from Oregon to South Carolina. So that kind of makes it special for Americans. But generally, eclipses are really rare, even though they happen every year and a half or so. And sometimes you could say there's a partial solar eclipse every year, but that's not where you are.
Yeah, in Antarctica or someplace like that.
If you were unwilling to travel and said, well, you know, I really like it here in Concord, New Hampshire, and I'm not going anywhere, you would wait on average of about 360 years between total solar eclipses happening over your house. So most people aren't that patient, right? So in order to improve those odds, you drive half a day, fly. So I've never seen a total solar eclipse in the United States. So I'm looking forward to it because it's right here.
The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, observations about this, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. exchange@nhpr.org is the email, or respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Mal Cameron is here, John Gianforte, Nicole Gallucci, and we're looking at the solar eclipse that is coming on Monday here in this country. And again, we'd love to hear from you. So we've talked about some of the excitement and, you know, how rare this is. But Nicole, what is it that scientists actually hope to learn from an eclipse? I mean, I think for most people, it's like they'll go watch it and they'll go, oh, that's really cool. But what about the three of you? What do you hope to learn from this?
So some scientists will be looking specifically at the sun's corona. So this is this outer atmosphere of the sun that will be visible to us during the eclipse. Usually it's much, much fainter than the rest of the sun that you see. So they will be studying that to try and determine what makes it so hot. It's something like 1,000,000 degrees, which is a lot hotter than the actual surface of the sun. So they'll be sending some instruments. I know there are a couple of NASA experiments that are putting infrared instruments on airplanes that will be chasing the eclipse.
I read about that, yeah.
Yeah, so they'll be looking specifically at the corona and trying to identify these mechanisms that make this outer atmosphere so hot. But there's also some science opportunities that people going to see the eclipse can actually take part in, these citizen science opportunities. One, like I briefly mentioned, animal behavior. There's a group that's studying or getting observations of animal behavior from citizen scientists, anyone who's going to be watching this eclipse that can report their observations. The Eclipse Mega Movie Project that's looking for pictures. So another way that people can participate in this eclipse. A couple of projects that involve looking at part of the Earth's atmosphere called the ionosphere and how that reacts during an eclipse. So people with amateur radio astronomy equipment can also take observations during this eclipse.
Wow, so lots of opportunities, Mal, for scientists and citizen scientists alike.
That's right. To add to that list, there are a couple of jet planes out. I forgot where they're flying from, but they're going to try to get up and follow as fast as they can. Of course, the shadow is moving 2,000 miles an hour, but they're going to go like close to the speed of sound anyway and try to stretch out that totality period with special instruments on board to get an extra minute or so
of
time.
It's a lot of effort for an extra
minute.
Right,
right. Yeah. That's about all they can muster. So instead of seeing a 2 minute or 2.5 minute totality, they'll see something maybe as much as a minute more than that. But to get a chance, as Nicole was saying, to study the corona is very important because that's the big puzzle about the sun. We don't know a lot about that. Why is it so hot compared to the surface of the sun? Surface of the sun is only about 10,000 degrees, right? And we're talking 1,000,000 degree corona, and no one knows how that works. So I've been trying to figure that puzzle out for years. But these jet planes are going to try to go as fast as they can without hurting anybody. But it's very tricky because they have to line up their instruments just right, too, and fly at a particular level way.
Well, I think I read that it's kind of bumpy at that level. It's
yes.
Not like when you fly commercial where they try to find, you know, a comfortable cruising altitude, as they put it. So,
yeah. Well, the plus is they are at an altitude. They're not down on the ground. So they're up in a little thinner atmosphere, and that can make things a little bit differently and see things perhaps a little more clearly as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the time frame because, John, I've been struck by, you know, how much scientists and citizen scientists hope to learn from this, but they've got like 2, maybe 2.5 minutes to learn it. It's kind of a lot of pressure.
These people in the airplane, I'd love to be a fly on the inside wall of that airplane, watching them stress through this, getting everything lined up, giving it right, combined with some possible turbulence. I'd love to watch that. That'd be a great video to watch. But that extra 2 minutes could be exactly what they need to find out the information about the solar corona, which has big effects, really big measurable effects on us here on Earth.
How does the corona affect us?
Well, the corona is the kind of like the casing around the sun above its surface. The visible surface of the sun that we can see is yellowish, called the photosphere. Then there's a cool region of gas called the chromosphere that's very pink that you can only see during a total solar eclipse, or see best during a total solar eclipse. And above this, there's a strange region called the transition region. And then just above the transition region, the temperature skyrockets to several 1,000,000 degrees in the corona. So sometimes there are holes in the corona, openings where charged particles flow out of the sun from 400 to 800 kilometers per second, And if those coronal holes are directed toward the Earth, those charged particles can interact with the Earth's magnetic field.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that.
And,
yeah.
And we can see northern lights, southern lights, and they can also affect radio communications because it affects the ionosphere. So if you're a person that studies the effects of on the Earth's ionosphere, because we use the ionosphere as a reflective layer for certain communication, radio frequency communication, that can be disrupted during one of these onslaughts from the solar wind.
So is that what I've heard, a coronal mass ejection?
That's a
or is that
bit,
something else?
That's supposed
to be tricky, too.
So the holes in the corona let the solar wind flow through more readily. And that's one thing that can affect us. But a coronal mass ejection is literally stuff, superheated plasma, being blown off the sun. It actually leaves the sun behind and travels through interplanetary space. And if it's directed toward the Earth, that stuff can interact with the Earth's magnetic field and cause even more serious effects.
Well, in a couple of minutes, I want to ask you guys more about weird solar weather that we might get, weird interference with our electronics. But our listeners have lots of questions, too. So let's go to them. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Jessica's calling from Raymond. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi. So this is probably a dumb question, but I seem to remember that there was a solar eclipse or a partial solar eclipse or something that came over Concord, New Hampshire in 1993. I was in the first grade, and it made a pretty big impression on me. So my question is, A, is my memory correct? And B, when was the last time a solar eclipse happened over New Hampshire?
No dumb questions, Jessica. Thank you very much for the call. Go ahead, Mel.
Jessica, thanks for that. I was hoping we might get to that, actually. There was a total eclipse of sorts that went over Concord, New Hampshire, right directly overhead, on May the 10th of 1994. So not too bad. You had it close. And this eclipse was a little different because it was called an annular eclipse. And it was very fortunate that it went right over Concord because we had, I remember I was working at the planetarium at that time, and we had news teams come up from Boston because they were just outside of this actual center. And it's called an annular eclipse. Annular actually means ring. They call it a ring of fire eclipse. And it happens because the moon is further away in its orbit. Think of the moon's orbit not as a perfect circle, always at the same distance from the Earth. It varies from being very close, what we call a perigee, and that's what gives us, or when it's a full moon at that point, that's called a supermoon. But then when it's further away, it's called apogee. And that, and this eclipse, it was more toward the apogee, so that the moon didn't quite fit completely over the complete disk of the sun. So when it gets dead center on the sun, there's still this extra rim or ring of fire around the edge of the moon, which is very pretty, but it's not something you can look at without eye protection still.
Well, I was wondering about that because someone was saying to me last night, you know, gee, if it's only partial here in Concord, you know, what's the harm? Is there a harm, Nicole, in watching a partial solar eclipse like we're going to get here in New Hampshire?
There is always harm at looking at the sun directly with your eyes. An eclipse itself isn't necessarily more harmful, but it's something we all want to look at. So we want to make sure that we have the right eye protection before we view a solar eclipse.
Okay, and we'll find out more on that after a short break. And keep taking your calls. Jessica, thank you for that one. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on the August 21st solar eclipse in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Thank you.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart, no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a crew of Granite State astronomers is here, and the big story we're looking at is the Great American Eclipse happening on Monday, August 21st. Later on, we'll look at two spacecraft from the 1970s who are still going strong. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Your comments about past events of solar eclipse or your questions about the one that's coming, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Also, check out The Exchange on our website today, nhpr.org, for great photos and links to some more information. And Mal and John and Nicole, a couple more questions about the eclipse before we turn to some of these other space science stories that I wanted to ask you. And John, just before the break, we were saying, can you watch an eclipse safely, a partial eclipse safely without eye protection? Or do you need to wear something?
You always need to wear something when you're looking at the sun. And like Nicole said, eclipses aren't any more dangerous to look at. It's just that you're curious and you know you should be looking at the sun. But you must do it with eye protection. From New Hampshire or from wherever else you view the eclipse, the only time you don't need eye protection is during the few moments of totality. You can take off the eye protection then. But as soon as the diamond ring effect occurs, that's a little peak of sun peeking from behind a crater or a mountain valley on the moon, that's time to put the eye protection back on. So with 62% of the sun covered, it doesn't mean that it's 62% better or more okay to look at the sun. Even 2% of the sun disk showing, 1% of the sun's disk showing from behind the moon is enough to cause eye damage.
Wow.
And it's not the brightness. It's not the brightness intensity of the sun that can singe your retina. It's the ultraviolet and infrared parts of the sun spectrum that can hurt your eyes. And there's enough infrared and ultraviolet that makes it through the atmosphere to the surface to hurt your eyes. And that's really what hurts. The solar glasses from an approved vendor block 99.999% of the sun's energy at all wavelengths.
I've heard that there are some, like, you know, scams and people selling, you know, cheap cardboard, whatever. I would like to watch what's happening here in Concord, but I don't want to damage my eyes. So, Nicole, what do I do? How do I know that I'm not getting, you know, ripped off?
Yeah, so there's a certain specification for these eclipse glasses that block out most of the visible as well as the ultraviolet infrared rays that could harm your eyes. I found a great resource. The American Astronomical Society has an eclipse webpage, and they have how to view a solar eclipse safely, along with a list of vendors that they know are reputable, because anyone can print the certification number and pretend that they, you know, actually are protecting. But they have a good list of vendors, so you can check if you've already gotten some. You can check against that list, or you can reach out and see if you can still get some with the little bit of time you have left. As I understand it, a lot of these glasses were distributed to libraries across
right,
the country,
yeah.
So you can always call your local library and see if they have more. You shouldn't have to spend more than a few bucks on them. They're not expensive.
Okay, so watch out for that if somebody's charging you $30 for these. Go ahead, Mal.
I think if you do a search for New Hampshire libraries that, you know, have the, there are some libraries, some of the big city ones especially, who were just given glasses to give away. The other thing you can use, if you know a welder, it's a number 14 welder's glass or higher number, but number 14 is what the cardboard glasses are essentially imitating, is that level. That's a good source if you want to look directly at the sun through something. Don't try to put something like that on. I mean, certainly don't take binoculars. Don't look at it through a telescope. But another trick is you can take a pair of binoculars and block off one side of it. Hold the binoculars not to your eyes, but take a piece of paper underneath the binoculars and hold it far enough away so you don't burn it. But you can look through the big end of the binoculars pointing toward the sun, and the small end aim toward the paper, and you can get an image that way.
Oh, wow. So put the big end of the binoculars
facing
up to the sky.
That's one trick that I saw online recently.
That is a tricky trick, Mal.
It is. But you don't want to – I mean, it's not like a magnifying glass. Of course, if you're taking just a magnifying glass, you're going to burn the paper. The other idea is to make a pinhole camera. There are various sources you can find online on how to do that.
The AWS site has instructions for a pinhole projector as well as the getting the solar glasses. So the pinhole camera, pinhole projector, you can make it out of a shoebox or any other kind of box, and the instructions are on the website.
Go ahead, Nicole.
My favorite is you can take a colander that you like strain pasta with, because those tiny holes will project an image of the sun as well. So you can just hold a colander out and look at its shadow, and you'll be able to see
a whole bunch of eclipses.
Multiple.
A whole bunch of little eclipses.
You'll see more eclipses than anyone else.
Yep.
Wow. Okay, so we talked earlier about radio waves getting interrupted, and thank goodness the eclipse is not happening at 9 a.m., so this show will not be interrupted. And we talked about the possibility of, you know, it getting cold and weird solar weather and how animals will react. Nicole, to you or anybody else, what about solar power? Are solar power plants going to shut down? Anybody know anything about that?
Well,
John?
So here's what's happening. Yes, it's like a cloud passing over the sun. And if you're a solar collector, or if you're getting your hot water or your electricity from a solar cell, that's going to interrupt. It's going to decrease the amount of solar radiation reaching your collectors for a period of time. And that will make a measurable drop in the efficiency of your solar collectors. So people aren't going to turn off their stoves or their air conditioners during the eclipse. They're going to expect power to be coming on demand like they always do. So power companies that supplement their nuclear or fossil fuel power generation plants are going to have to closely watch the output from their solar plants and make up the difference during the eclipse, the partial phases as well as the total phases, and very carefully ramp up their supplemental supplies so that we on the grid using the electricity don't see any serious degradation.
Well, there's not that much solar power on our grid here in New England.
There's certainly not enough, but in places in the Sun Belt where there are solar plants, they have to be very concerned and careful. But with careful management, things should take place just fine, because they have methods to measure the output of their solar plants.
Well, and I read that in Germany in 2015, they had an eclipse and they figured it out the way that you said, John. You know, they kind of just had everything else at the ready, and Germany has a ton of solar energy. So it was maybe a bigger deal for them. Let's take another call. This is Eileen in Concord. Hi, Eileen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I was just wondering what kind of eclipse we had back in the winter of 1969-70. I was new here, and I remember watching it through a pinhole in cardboard on the snowbank.
Well, and it was probably cold, and you were patient to do that. Does anybody have any thoughts or memories about...
Where I was in 1970, it was a partial eclipse.
Yeah.
So I do. I wasn't in New England, but I remember the eclipse, but I wasn't... I don't remember much detail about it, although I did see it.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Eileen. One more question about the eclipse, and then there's a bunch of other space-related headlines that I want to cover with you folks. Another American solar eclipse is forecast for 2024. Do I have that right, Nicole?
Yes, I'm super excited. So the path of totality is going to cross the U.S. again in April 2024. April the 8th. Thank you.
Right. Mark it on your calendar.
Mark it now.
He's got
I'm sure it's on your calendar.
Right. I've got reservations.
So this one's going to be... So the advice I've gotten from friends who've seen many eclipses are like, take this first one for you and enjoy it. You know, don't try and do any teaching or outreach. Just, you know, experience it. So I'm doing that this time. And then the 2024 one, we're going to, you know, hit it hard with, we're going to have a big eclipse party. We're going to do something. 7 years is a little bit of time to plan. But it'll cross through northern New Hampshire. And so we'll definitely be having some, you know, activities and viewing parties going on up here.
Wow. So people who can't travel, like the three of you are, to see the total solar eclipse, it's going to cross through New Hampshire, this path of totality?
Yeah, it's going to cross through northern New Hampshire. So where I'll be paying attention to see how towns and cities handle the huge influx of people this time around, because we'll have that. We'll have our own show to give in 7 years.
Well, what are the chances, Mal? I mean, you know, there's been so much hype about first time in 100 years. This has crossed the mainland U.S. and then not that
right.
far down the road.
This
another
one is... It won't be crossing the entire mainland in 2024. It's actually going to start like in Mexico and work its way up through Texas and kind of northeast and eventually cross into New York State and across the northern part of Vermont and New Hampshire into Canada. And then the rest of it will actually go through a band around the middle part of the state of Maine.
Huh.
So that's another place to go to. But that's not till 2024. The interesting part, we were talking about this beforehand, is that the eclipse this time, one of the places it's crossing is where Nicole's going to be, right? Excuse me. And there's a section in the country in southern Illinois in the northwestern part of Kentucky. Carbondale, Illinois, is a big hot spot. And there's another little town in Kentucky called Hopkinsville. And that is where it's going to cross on the 21st this year. In 2024, the next eclipse that's partially covering most that we just described also goes across that same area. So that Carbondale
no,
and Hopkinsville or whatever, they're going to see another eclipse going in a different direction in 2024.
That's pretty amazing.
And there's complaints being filed already.
Right.
About that not being fair.
Why did they claim this? Why not us?
People who, you know, get that extra capacity, maybe clean up that extra room so they can rent it out on Airbnb or something.
Yeah.
They can just keep it going.
But this one on the 21st is a very rare one for us in the United States. You're absolutely right. The last one that crossed from the West Coast to the East Coast was in 1918. So 99 years ago. So this is a very rare event. And if you are fortunate enough, my guess is if you try to travel there now and you need a place to stay overnight, you're going to have to pay for it royally.
Yeah.
Because everybody's taking advantage of this.
Well, next time. And again, check out the maps and photos and all that we have on our website, because it gives you a sense of this sort of dramatic coast-to-coast sweep. So check it out, nhpr.org. You can give us a call right now, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Nicole, a couple birthdays, anniversaries, fail world parties being observed this month by space scientists. The Mars rover Curiosity turns 5. Now, what's significant about that?
That is very exciting. So I don't know how many of you were watching that particular landing of the Mars Curiosity rover, because it was, 7 minutes?
7 minutes
of terror.
Of terror, yes.
Yes. So we all watched because they had this really complex sky crane scheme to land this rather large rover on the surface of Mars. So a lot of
how
people
big is
are,
it?
I want to say it was about the size of a VW bug.
SUV.
Oh, SUV.
That's pretty big.
Okay,
right,
okay.
Yeah.
So quite a bit bigger.
That's how
that's
how NASA describes it.
Okay.
They compare it to the other rovers.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah. So Curiosity's been doing a lot of geological work and looking at evidence of Mars's wet past. So the water that was once on Mars, potentially stable as lakes and oceans. So it's very exciting to see that turn 5. As we know, the Mars rovers have a knack for sticking around much longer than they were originally planned to do. And in particular, Mars Curiosity, a lot of people love it and follow it on Twitter. So it's actually got a pretty good Twitter following at Mars Curiosity.
What do you think, John? How important is this fifth birthday?
Well, it's a long mission. It was supposed to last a long time. The previous rovers had limited expected life expectancy of 90 days. And, of course, we know Opportunity is still roving 13 years after it landed.
Okay, that's amazing.
So that really is amazing, although it's not Opportunity's birthday. That's in January, right? So at least in terms of being on Mars. But Curiosity is a much more sophisticated chemical analysis laboratory that it carries on board, in addition to higher quality cameras to send back images. And this rover is climbing up a 6 kilometer high mountain to look at sedimentary rock strata. So you know that on Earth, we have rocks that form in the presence of water by deposition of different layers. And Mars has that too, which indicates to geologists and planetary scientists that similar processes took place on Mars. And that's what Curiosity went to Mars to find out.
A wet pass that Nicole talked about.
Was it ever habitable, or is it today habitable perhaps somewhere? Maybe not on Mars, but maybe inside of Mars. So that's what Curiosity is trying to do. It's trying to look under rocks, drill into rocks to see if there is evidence of past habitability.
So will Opportunity, John, come over for Curiosity's birthday party?
Probably not.
They'll probably tweet each other, though.
Yeah, really?
I expect that. Yes, you see the rovers tweet each other and all that stuff. they do a great job at social media outreach at NASA.
Another birthday, a more venerable birthday,
let me just,
Mal.
If I may add to the Curiosity thing, is that John was saying that it was designed to last a long time. Curiosity is different in the way it's powered. If you go back to Spirit and Opportunity, those were powered by solar panels, and that was the typical way. Oh, Mars is just a little ways away. We can use solar power. The problem with Mars is it's very dusty.
Right, and those solar panels get dust.
They get dusted. And then every now and then, dust devil comes along and cleans them off.
Right.
But you can't really rely on that. So the Curiosity rover, or the Mars Science Lab, as it really technically was known, is powered by nuclear power, just the way they powered we're going to talk about Voyager and some of the others because they're going far out there. So that's going to last a lot longer, and you don't have to worry about the dust.
Well, let's talk about Voyager. And Mal, I want to kick it off with you, but hear from everybody. These are two spacecraft launched in the late 70s, 40 years ago, 1977. Yep. One writer called them cosmic overachievers. I love that. Are they cosmic overachievers?
Well, they certainly have achieved a lot more than we had hoped.
They can turn 40 feeling satisfied.
Right. Absolutely. And they don't even have gray hairs. But yeah, they've been trucking right along out there. They were launched. They're right now. Voyager 1 is almost 13 billion miles from the Earth. And then Voyager 2 is about 11 billion miles, only because it took a little longer to start out of the solar system, because Voyager 2 was the one that gave us those great pictures of the close-ups of not just Jupiter and Saturn, as Voyager 1 did, but it also went on to look at Uranus and Neptune before it left. But the two are going in two different directions. Voyager 1 is heading out of the north end of the planetary plane, if you want to call it that, and then Voyager 2 is heading south. But they're both outside of what we would call the heliosphere of the solar system.
That's sort of that bubble of
the bubble,
sun that
right, of
keeps
energy,
the solar system,
if you will.
Yeah. Sort of together. All right, a lot more. I want to hear from you guys, too, on the Voyagers, because they are pretty amazing. And also coming up, there may be more water on the moon than we thought. Also, Saturn's moon Titan is pretty cool, so we'll talk about that. You can join us, too, the number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our crew of Granite State Astronomers is here. We're taking your questions and comments. We've talked a lot about the coming solar eclipse on August 21st. You can join us on that. We're also learning more about the Voyager missions launched 40 years ago. Happy birthday to a Mars rover. And in a moment, we'll be talking about probe that has been circling Saturn and what we've learned there. You can join us, too, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Mal, John, Nicole, let's go right back to our listeners. Dan's in Epsom. Hi, Dan. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. Just really interesting to hear you guys talk about this, because my last duty station in the Air Force was at a solar observatory here on the North Shore of Massachusetts. I got there, and I thought, oh, wow, we'll have really big telescopes. And instead we didn't. We had antenna dishes varying from, I think one was a 28-foot down to a 6-foot. But either way, it was unreal how I had only been there, I guess, about a little more than a year and a half, and we were closing down for the day. Sun was going down on the horizon, and we, in October of 2003, we had the most horrific, violent burst of solar, I guess you'd call it a coronal mass ejection, I believe it up to the time that they'd ever seen. But that night, the sky was red and white.
Wow.
With the northern lights. If you look, go online, you can still see.
In Massachusetts, Dan.
Yes, but this horrific burst of solar energy, the region that produced it was not aimed at the Earth. Actually, it was aimed fairly obliquely away, but still what it produced was just absolutely tremendous as far as the northern lights. But
Dan, hang on, because I think John Gene Forty wants to jump in. Go ahead, John.
Was that on Halloween night?
Well, I don't know if it's actually Halloween night. They still call it the Halloween storms of 2003.
Yeah, that was Halloween night. I remember it very well, and we saw a great aurora display right here in New Hampshire that night. There were lots of sunspots on the sun during that period of time, because I had just taken photographs of the sun, and it was just dotted with really active regions of activity. And that can account for this huge burst that you witnessed.
So cool. Dan, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it. I wanted to go back to our conversation about Voyager. Mal described the launch and what these probes have been doing for the last 40 years, which is incredible. And they're super far now, 11 billion and 13 billion miles out, which is incredible. Why are these so just impressive? And how do they keep doing it, Nicole?
So the Voyager spacecraft gave us our first really good close-up look or tour of the outer solar system. So these gas and ice giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, their host of moons, their rings, the active volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io, really gave us that close-up look that we didn't have of these worlds. And what's so impressive about it now, it's actually being called, and putting up air quotes, the interstellar mission, because it is in some ways beyond the sun's influence into this interstellar space. So they're the first probes, the first machines built by humans that have actually left the solar system, which is super impressive. And it continues one way they continue to save power by shutting down certain instruments that they're not using so that they can still take scientific data and see what the environment is like beyond the sun's influence.
So way, way beyond the solar system, the first instruments built by people that can do that. I read something interesting, John, and maybe I'll ask you about it, that since this was 40 years ago, current NASA scientists need to rely on the old-timers, because those are the people who have the expertise in the 1970s technology that these things basically had. They were launched in the 70s.
Oh, that's right. It's very, very early technology compared to what's available now. And scientists like JPL's Ed Stone, who was a principal investigator on one of the missions, was instrumental and is still called upon to give input. And so a lot of the instruments are shut down. The television cameras are no longer functional. They require a lot of power. There's not a lot of power to be had from these old thermoelectric radioisotope generators, which is how the spacecraft makes electricity. From the decay of radioactive components, they produce heat. From the heat, it produces electricity. But that's a long time. So the number of watts available for science instruments and for radios is diminishing. It's getting to the point now where it's how much longer are they going to last? So that's one of the true great things about these missions, and they gave us the best images, at least to that date in the 1979-1980 period when we first sent these probes out there. To give you an idea of just how far away they are, the most distant planet or former planet that most people know about, Pluto, is 3.5 billion miles from the sun. So these are several times further than what once was the most distant planet. But as far away from the sun as they are, there are solar system objects, the other dwarf planets similar to Pluto, that are even further than Pluto is. And these spacecraft haven't approached that yet. So in many ways, the spacecraft are a part of interstellar space. It's the place in space where the solar wind is not as influential as the interstellar solar wind, that is, solar wind coming from other stars. And that's the mark of a spacecraft entering interstellar space.
I see. That's what makes this kind of jaw-dropping. And Nicole, did you want to jump in on that?
Oh, yeah. So it's amazing to think of how far they are. But in terms of astronomical distances, I mean, they're basically like next door still, right? So if they were, so the Voyager spacecraft, it's going to take them another, 40, 50,000 years just to come close to another close star. So yes, it's super far out, but also it's around the block.
Well, 40,000 years, that's not very much.
Go ahead, Matt.
The remarkable thing is that it's still sending signals back to us.
I read about that. That is incredible. I wonder how that even happens.
The power is so low that I was reading recently that the power decreases on the Voyagers by roughly 4 watts every year. And the original part of the power from Voyager was barely enough to power a refrigerator light bulb. And it's still sending signals back. But the problem is those signals are very, very weak.
I'm guessing,
and we
sure.
pick them up through something called the DSN, the Deep Space Network, which are huge antennae, three of them around the Earth. But by the time that power gets here, we reach it at 1/10 of a billion trillionth of 1 watt of power reaches our antennas, and those antennas are able to decipher, oh, this is from Voyager. This is from Voyager 1.
That's a pretty faint phone call.
This is from Voyager 2. Quiet, everybody. I'm listening.
Yeah. You know, one more quick question about Voyager, and then we should move on to a couple other topics because I do want to ask about Titan and Cassini. But Mal, we talked about this before. Voyager, one of the Voyagers, has that golden record, right? Like all right. the sounds and from Earth, because as Nicole said, it's kind of intriguing, interstellar space, like who's out there? Who might these probes meet? So there's this record aboard one of them, right, that has exactly. beautiful music, whale sound. We played some of this on an earlier show.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an idea of Carl Sagan's, for one. He was in on it, and they helped design. On it is a disc-like, an old vinyl record album. Would
sure,
be,
that was
probably
the technology
roughly
at the
design.
Time.
And it has pictographs on it of figuring any intelligent beings that it could come across would be able to decipher to say, okay, this object came from this location in space. There's a planet there. This is an outline of a human being, and so this is who they are. And, of course, the big joke that was going around at one time was, oh, look, here's a place we can find these creatures, and guess what? They're made out of meat.
Yes, that thought crossed my mind. The other thought that crossed my mind is there's a Star Trek movie where the intelligent beings communicate with whales, so they'll like the whale sound.
And also, this is a Star Trek movie, the original one, was where they
please,
come
Mal.
Across.
No, Mal, don't.
Yeah,
V-ger.
Don't bring that one
up. Oh, my goodness. You're kidding me.
Skip right to Retcon, guys.
All right, we'll go to another call. This is Sarah in Bedford. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I was just wondering, back to the eclipse.
Sure.
On the 21st of August, I'll be taking a commercial flight from Seattle to Boston, and I'm wondering, we take off at 11 o'clock, I'm wondering if I will experience at 30,000 feet any sort of any part of that eclipse, what I might see.
11 o'clock Seattle time, Sarah?
Seattle time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I would advise you to look at some of the maps and so forth that
I may be able to
give you a little more
that for you, Sarah.
Clearly, but yeah.
I noticed on Pacific time that it starts in Oregon around 9:05 in the morning.
That's the partial phases.
That's the partial phases. But totality is around 10:15.
In Oregon.
In Oregon. Yes. So you'll be just outside of the in Washington State, in Seattle, you'd be just outside the edge of it. So you'll see most of it, but not the total from Seattle.
Okay. Maybe you can talk to the pilot about modifying their flight plan.
Right. Fly into Oregon first and then come on.
Just cancel your flight and stick around.
There you go.
Well, exactly. Actually, it's
oops,
not
I
a
missed problem. The flight.
Sarah, good luck to you, and thank you for the call. So I did want to ask you, Nicole, about Saturn, and more specifically, Saturn's moon Titan. Now, why have scientists been so interested in a moon of Saturn?
So Saturn itself is a gas giant. When we look for places where life can exist or may have existed in the solar system, Saturn itself isn't really great for that. But its moon Titan, one of the largest moons in the solar system, has some really interesting geology and chemistry that attract the attention of astrobiologists. So there was a recent observation of Titan using a ground-based telescope called ALMA. It's the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. It's at a high site in the Chilean mountains. It's a radio telescope, an array of dishes. And they detected these chemicals, one in particular called vinyl cyanide, which is interesting to astrobiologists and astrochemists because under certain conditions, this molecule can arrange itself into something resembling a cellular membrane.
Really?
So it's an interesting chemical that might point to what chemistry was like leading up to the formation of life, for example, on Earth. So there's no evidence of, you know, critters crawling around on Titan or anything like that. But it is an interesting data point in the question of what does it take to have life arise on some habitable location. Now, Titan would not be habitable for us, but
too cold,
too full of methane and weird chemicals that we can't breathe. But you could imagine life not like us that could exist in those chemical conditions.
Well, and in the past, we've talked on this program about several moons that hold scientific interest, maybe just as much as their planets, or as Nicole is saying, maybe even more than their planets. John, which other moons have we been looking at, and how come?
One more thing about Titan I should point out, though, that Titan is the only moon in the solar system of any of the planets that has a substantial atmosphere. It's actually 1.5 times denser than Earth's atmosphere. And it's the only moon in the solar system that has interaction between a liquid body on the surface and the atmosphere, which astrobiologists go gaga over. Right? Very interesting chemistry there. It's looked at as a very early but cold Earth analog.
Huh.
Right? So other moons in the solar system, Europa around Jupiter. We've talked about that before.
Lots of ice.
A moon a little bit smaller than Earth's moon with a 10 to 15 kilometer thick layer of icy water crust floating on an ocean of liquid water. Salty,
that's pretty intriguing.
Salty water that has stained the surface of Europa. And when analyzed, that stain looks like it contains compounds similar to Epsom salts. So it's not just regular fresh water, it's salty water, which means it lowers the freezing point of water below 32 or below 0 degrees Celsius. Other moons, Enceladus of Saturn, the moon, the very small moon that has geysers of liquid water spraying out of the southern pole that are known to contain organic compounds. So this was totally unexpected by Cassini. It arrived at Saturn in 2004 and detected these geysers of water in 2005, and one of the hallmark discoveries of that mission. So these are two other moons, and there are other moons too, and we're finding that the moons of the solar system offer tantalizing possibilities for the existence of life. Not aliens with ray guns, but maybe microbial life.
Sure. So speaking of that, Mal, our own moon here. Some astronomers now think it has more water than previously believed. What's behind that thinking?
Well, apparently some of the water got into glass that was formed from the heat of the sun as the moon was being formed. And some there is not as clear on this, but what I was reading recently on it is that if the, you can get onto the moon and even with robots or even with people, that it is possible to take this glass, break it apart, and all this moisture will come out.
Wow.
We do know that there is a much more, a larger quantity of water ice in the poles of the moon where the sun doesn't get down in there and it stays there. But the difficulty is getting down out of sight of Earth to be very dangerous to get in there and try to break that apart too. But of course, we want to be able to do that because you can break apart the hydrogen and the oxygen of water, and you can even create fuel out of that if you can get more water out of it.
All right. So the
very moon rocks you saw when you went to Houston, Mal, I think you're the only one of us here that has actually been in the same room that the moon rocks. Reanalyzing those moon rocks have revealed the presence of this extra water that we weren't good enough to find 40 years ago.
Okay, so Nicole's taking off for Illinois, John for Tennessee, Mal for South Carolina for the eclipse, not this Monday, but next Monday. I expect pictures. I expect
tweets.
A little bit of, information.
You can
send me a postcard. That sounds good. Safe travels, everybody. And I hope, by the way, that the weather is clear. Because a cloud could.
I'm already having nightmares.
Don't say that.
I'm already having nightmares.
I won't say it. Clear skies, safe travels for all of you. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate
thank
it.
You, Laura.
Nicole, it's good to have you. Thank you. Nicole Gallucci, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at St. Anselm College. John, good to see you. Thank you.
Great to be here, Laura.
John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. Mal Cameron, thank you also for your time.
My pleasure, Laura.
Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. Again, go to our website, check out photos and links. By the way, all our guests are wearing space gear, so we might put a picture up there too. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.